This is Cross-Platform 4, May 12th, 2007, Episode 8.
So welcome to another episode of Cross Platform. I've got three terrific guests here. We're going to talk about a lot of things, such as the Xbox 360 and game journalism. First, let's introduce the guests. We have first N'Guy Kroll. He is the general editor of Newsweek and a writer for the technology section of the same magazine. He's been working at Newsweek since 1995 and also has a blog called N'Guy Kroll's Level Up, which talks about gaming, game journalism, other interesting topics. Thank you for coming on the show, N'Guy.
Thanks for having me, Luke.
Our next guest is we have Dean Takahashi. Dean is a columnist for the San Jose Mercury News, where he works on technology section of the paper. He also writes a blog for the Mercury News and also has a podcast called Dean and Nooch on Gaming. Finally, he is a writer of two books on the Microsoft Xbox and Xbox 360. Thanks for coming back on the show again, Dean.
Yeah, thank you, Luke.
And finally, we have Kyle Orland. Kyle Orland is a freelance writer for Joystick and other sites such as The Escapist, Game Daily, Gamma Sutra, and other countless gaming sites. He also can be heard on the gaming podcast called Press Start on NPR's Alt podcast section. And he's also a co-author for a new book coming out this year called The Video Game Style Guide and Reference Manual. Thanks for coming on the show, Kyle.
Thanks for having me.
When's that going to be coming out?
Finishing up the final manuscript of the book, and then it should be a week or two before we have the e-version, and then it has to get sent to the printers, so another month or so after that. So look for it in the summer.
Awesome.
Very good.
So anyway, let's start off with the little versus fight that N'Guy and Dean had a while ago. You guys were talking about, I guess, was it you, N'Guy, that started this all?
Well, yeah, what happened was Stephen Totillo at MTV and I came up with the idea of doing, sort of a back-and-forth exchange modeled after the dialogues on Slate. It's the, God of War 2, a game. And then I wanted to sort of continue the versus mode stuff, and it just so happened that right around the time that we published our my versus mode exchange with Stephen about God of War 2, that the Xbox 360 Elite was finally officially announced by Microsoft. Around the same time, or a week before, I'd been having a little email exchange with Dean, and I approached Dean and said, hey, we're having a pretty interesting debate. Why don't we sort of let the world in on it? And, Dean was kind enough to agree, and that's how Dean and I came to do the three-day versus mode exchange on the Xbox 360 Elite, as well as the PSP and its price cut.
Yeah, and I had an advantage because I could type fast there, but N'Guy speaks so much faster than I. If we did a podcast type thing, I just would have been killed by N'Guy. But when I take 12 hours to respond, then I think I have it's more like an even match.
And even it was. Dean did a great job, raised some provocative questions. I think some people felt that we were agreeing too much. But I thought, there were some points of differentiation and distinction, and, went for those. And it was, it was an honor to do it, to do versus mode with Dean, and I'd do it again if the situation arose.
Thank you.
Talking about that, what are some of the problems that you guys find with the Xbox 360 Elite?
I think was a little more favorably inclined to judge it than N'Guy was. And I think if I look at it as a point in a larger strategy, then it seems to make some sense. If you look at it as just a product by itself, it doesn't have a whole lot to offer you. Larger hard drive and HDMI port. And The value of either one of those is not so directly relevant to gamers. HDMI is sort of in this realm of can you really tell the difference between one kind of HD gaming and another, resed up version of HD gaming. And a large hard drive is really more important to people who want to buy a lot of movies, download them, and watch them on their Xbox 360. So that's what I said was wrong with it. What I said was right about it, that I think NGuy didn't agree with so much, was that if you position this in as part of the product lineup, and over time you bring down the price and you bring the new 65 nanometer chips that, you know, cut the costs and miniaturize things, and you bring this down as like a $400 high end model at some point, and then you also integrate IPTV into it so that a telephone company can use it as a set-top box to compete against a cable TV company, then as a piece of a strategy, it's much more interesting, and it could put more pressure on someone like Sony. So, sorry, that was my argument.
I felt that on the first that it wasn't, while it was in, I mean, clearly, the price is not going to remain $479. I felt a couple of things. One is that, it was another example of how, Microsoft was price gouging with this generation. So, if you were to buy the core device, the 20 gigabyte drive, they were charging $100 for. Now they're charging $179 for the 120 gigabyte hard drive. Sort of the accessories are like highly priced and stuff like that. So I felt like this was another in a line of sort of, Microsoft really trying to, strip mine the hardcore gamer. And the problem with that is going to be that, Microsoft's argument is that the core, the $299 device, is what they say it is, the core consumer. Well, the core consumer is buying the premium. That's what they're actually doing. They're not selling large numbers of the core, because if they were, they would have sold a lot more hardware, and they wouldn't have had to cut their estimates for the end of their fiscal in June from 13 to 15 million to 12 million. Consumers have effectively rejected the core. And so that means that the average person and the early adopter, who's the person who would most be interested in buying an Elite, they've already spent on the premium. So to ask them to pay to buy it again, which Microsoft says they're not doing, they say it's for new consumers. Well, the problem with that is that, the people who come in after the early adopters, the more people you add, the more price sensitive they are. So for just HDMI and a larger hard drive, how do you justify charging more? If they had introduced this at $399 and eliminated the premium, sure, they'd sell it. That's understandable, but I think Microsoft is looking at, there's some dynamics here that, they think they're going to take advantage of. Maybe it's IPTV down the road. Maybe it's sort of, they had an inkling that Sony was going to get rid of the $499 device and $479 looks better against $600. And the problem is that at that price range, the people who are buying are making a decision to either get a 360 or a PS3. It's not that $479 is less than $599 or that kind of thing. I don't think that people, once you cross to $300, people are making a decision based on which device they want. And so I didn't get what Microsoft was trying to do. So once we get through this first month, where I think they'll probably do fairly well with it, and I don't think they put that many out there, it's going to fall off. I don't think people want to pay $479 for a 120 gigabyte hard drive and HDMI. And until Microsoft figures out a way to more strongly differentiate their product, I think you're going to see what you already saw, which is that there's one model of Xbox 360 that consumers are thinking about buying, and it's the premium, at whatever price the premium is.
If I can jump in, I think one of the things that could have set the Elite apart, which I'm surprised Microsoft didn't include, is a Wi-Fi adapter. The Nintendo DS, which is under $200, has a Wi-Fi in it, but a $480 system, they can't put in a little antenna to do it. Instead, you have to buy this $100 proprietary attachment if you want wireless internet on there. I think that was a missed opportunity for the Elite. Could have added a little bit more value for the later consumers there.
Well, I think that's a good point. I think the reason they're doing that is that, they lost $5 billion or so on the first machine. they've lost another X amount of dollars on the current one, and they're very much trying to get to a profit. I'm pretty sure that Robbie Bach is under a directive from the board and from his bosses that they have to be profitable this generation. Wi-Fi would take away from that, so they're taking this out. I mean, I think this was all based on a previous assumption that Sony was going to do better in the marketplace at $499 and $599 than they're currently doing, and they're sort of stuck with that device, and they're putting it out now.
That's true, although profitability has never been really in the hardware. I think if you put Wi-Fi in there, there's going to be more people who are going to be likely to buy the hardware and then buy software, which is actually where Microsoft makes most of its money on the licensing fees.
I think we're just talking about something like a $10 cost.
Exactly. How much does it really add to there?
Well, but that's what I'm saying. I think that they're definitely under pressure to turn a profit, because that $10 you put onto, you know, every box, that's like at least one more third-party game or one in X amount of third-party games that you have to sell per box to make that up. You know, over enough boxes over time, it adds up.
And isn't the Xbox division, the home entertainment division, one of the only divisions that's actually losing money?
They actually renamed that division, called the Entertainment and Devices division now. And yeah, they're still losing money. I think in the last quarter it was $315 million.
But they're building up that brand. That's what's important.
Right.
They've sunk so much money into this that it better be.
Yeah.
Well, that's why I'm saying it's not about the consumer. Like, charging $100 for the 20-gigabyte hard drive and $180 for the 120-gigabyte hard drive is not about the consumer. Leaving Wi-Fi out is not about the consumer. Only putting HDMI in as the meaningful differentiator when they've declared all along that all you need for 1080p is component, that's not about the consumer. I mean, that's about, you know, you have to remember, Microsoft's history in software is like, you know, is checklist marketing against the competition, and that's what this is. They're trying to make sure that whatever Sony says they have, we have it too. And, you know, I don't think that's going to work in this generation.
That's not really a strategy to win, for sure. And if you just match what your other guy has, then, you know, you haven't differentiated yourself.
It's a difference between software and hardware.
Yeah, I think just one point to make about that hard drive. You can get desktop hard drives for far cheaper than what you're paying extra here. But you have to remember, it's a special laptop hard drive that they have, the enclosure, and that. They can only get that from one or two sources.
What about the transfer cable? I mean, the transfer cable, it seems like it's kind of stupid that you can only transfer your stuff from one hard drive to the other. And then also, what happens when you're done with that cable? I mean, isn't this also kind of economically stupid for Xbox Microsoft to be putting out this cable that you can only use probably once or twice in your whole life, and then have it there just to lay waste?
Well, one of the challenges is always determining, like, what's the gap between the rhetoric and the reality, or sort of like what they're saying publicly and what they believe privately. Publicly, they're saying that they don't expect a significant number of people who already own a 360 to buy the Elite. They think that, you know, they're saying, like, it's meant for. It's meant for new consumers. And if that's the case, then you do what they've done, which is, you know, you have to register online and they'll send you the cable for free because they don't want to piss you off. But, you know, that's not the focus. The problem is that I really don't think that's the case. The people I know, and it's just anecdotal, it's a handful, the people I know who've gone out to get an Elite are people who already owned a Premium.
Yeah, I mean, I can't think there's a whole lot of logic to it right now. I do think that IPTV is sort of that wild card out there. And it sort of is why you need a 120 gig hard drive. You know, if you're going to turn your machine into a digital video recorder, you got to have enough space to record things. And IPTV, if you've seen it in demos at all, you know, you get a better offering out of that than you do out of cable TV.
Oh, yeah, I'm going to have to change the subject because we're already 15 minutes into this and I want to get really into game journalism.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Because game journalism, I think this is probably the biggest thing, especially nowadays with Jaffe yelling at Joystick and also Luke Smith leaving the 1UP. It's really starting to get interesting to look into the game journalism section of video games, and it's starting to become a lot more in the front stage. How do you see journalism, and I'll start with off with Kyle, how do you see game journalism compared to other entertainment journalism, such as film or TV?
Well, it's a tough question. It's so much younger than all other types of entertainment journalism, just like video games are, you know, the youngest of all the media. It's taken a while for video game journalism to even start to ask questions about itself. And, you know, it's kind of in the navel-gazing phase right now. Like, what are we doing? Why are we doing this? What is criticism? What should our news be? What are the conflicts of interest? It's really just barely started to develop now. I think as time goes on, you're going to start to see sort of generally agreed upon standards for reviews, for criticism, for ethics. They're going to sort of come about, and there's, you know, not everyone is going to sign off. There's still going to be small fan sites and things all over the internet that are just saying whatever they want. But you're going to get a coalescing around a sort of standard way of writing about games, I think.
I would interject that, you know, for a while there were some enlightened mainstream publications that started doing more and more video game coverage as it became more and more important. And part of the logic there was that newspapers and magazines were losing young readers, and we had to find a way to appeal to those readers. And, you know, by writing about video games, the things that they cared about, we would keep them and get them back. And I think that's what started a lot of us on the road to covering video games. One of the worries I have right now is that newspapers are still in a very bad state. The internet is really, you know, socking it to us. The advertisers are leaving and going online, and online we're just sort of one more choice that they have out of many, many choices. And so the business is still under attack. And in that environment, you know, I think you may see some mainstream publications just retrench. And because they're losing staff members, they may decide to cut the video game coverage. And, you know, that is like sort of, you know, cutting off your future in a lot of ways. But as a matter of cost cutting, I worry that that's going to happen.
Well, I think you're already seeing that. I mean, you know, my friend Jeff Keighley, who freelances for Entertainment Weekly, you know, back around 2000, 2001, 2002, Entertainment Weekly and Newsweek were both doing, like, you know, a game a week, you know, or a game every other week reviewed in the magazine. You know, we put the PlayStation 2 on the cover pegged to its Japanese launch. You know, there was, I mean, the economy was still rolling, and there was still a sense that, you know, that this stuff was interesting to cover from time to time. And I'd say now, Entertainment Weekly gives more coverage to comic books and graphic novels than they do video games. They push their video game coverage online, and the bulk of the coverage I do is online on my blog for Newsweek. You know, that's a, you know, now the question is the glass half empty or half full? I mean, look, I'm just thrilled that Newsweek is willing to pay me my salary to, among other things, write about games. And honestly, online, I much prefer to write about games online because I can reach I can speak to an audience that, you know, sort of straddles an enthusiast audience, a mainstream audience, a business audience. I can write about what I want, when I want, as frequently as I want. That's stuff that I simply print. And while it's not reaching the same audience that it would have reached through Newsweek, I think it's reaching a more interested and committed audience. And it's more interesting to me to write for that kind of audience than simply a general interest audience that may not be generally interested in what I'm writing about.
The thing about gamers, more than any other media audience, you know, more than TV watchers or people who are really into movies, is that they're tech savvy and that they're going to be going online for their news. They've, you know, grown up with computers and online as part of their life. So I don't know that newspapers and magazines are really going to be part of their gaming media diet going forward. But on the other hand, though, as time goes on, you're going to have the people in positions of power at these magazines and newspapers who didn't grow up with video games. They're going to start retiring, and the new people who are coming in will have grown up with video games and will be saying to their editors, hey, you know, we really have to be covering this stuff. It's a big thing. It's not new to them. It's part of the culture to them, and just like TV and movies are for the current baby boomer generation that's starting to go out. So I think those are going to kind of conflict with each other in the mainstream space.
So do you think it's hard to educate the editors about video games?
Well, the editor at Newsweek, we have a new editor at Newsweek, and he doesn't play games. The majority of my editors don't play games. And, you know, if they're in their 30s and 40s and they don't play games, you know, maybe they'll get a Wii and play it with their kids a little bit. Maybe they'll go on Pogo or some other casual game service, but they're not going to be interested to the point of, I mean, you know, you look at a magazine like Newsweek, you know, our main centers of power within the magazine are national and international coverage. That's it. That's what the focus is on. We focus a lot on religion lately. That's another area that's of interest to our editor. He's very literary. He's written books about, you know, Churchill and Roosevelt and things like that. That's the stuff that interests him. You know, games aren't as interesting. And, you know, I don't know that I can turn that around, you know, overnight. But what I do think I can do, one of the things I've done on my blog is I've gotten other people within Newsweek of varying ages. Some of them are young, some of them are older, to write about their game-related experiences. So, you know, I had a senior editor here write about his efforts to try and find a Wii for his teenage sons. I have another, you know, assistant managing editor, so further up the food chain, who's going to write a piece for me about her young daughter and getting her a DS and getting her into games and things like that. And so, you know, I've likened, you know, what I'm doing to sort of, you know, outing the other gamers inside Newsweek. And I think by doing that and by having the blog that is the most read by, I'm told, an order of magnitude of all our blogs, regardless of subject matter, I think that sort of, you know, I can't say that's going to change what we do in print, but I think it forces them to sort of realize that, you know, gaming does matter.
I enjoy blogging for much the same reasons that NGuy does, that, you know, we have this targeted audience. I can say what I want. I could do a lot more coverage than I can. It's a very similar situation where in my day job, writing columns, just a very small percentage of them are on games now, and it's just a lot more fun. I think we're both in interesting jobs, like many other journalists out there, where the day job sort of gets you access to a lot of the important people. So because I work at San Jose Mercury News, I get interviews with a lot of the game executives or companies or game developers. And that sort of really feeds sort of the uniqueness of the blog posts, and so we can do things with our blog that that elevate it as a result. And what I think will be the interesting question for the future, you know, I'm actually reading a book called The New Influencers by Paul Gillen right now. It's about a marketer's guide to the new social media, and it's a lot about the growing influence of bloggers. And so a lot of journalists in the future are going to sort of make this decision about, you know, should I still work for the mainstream publication, or should I go off on my own and have fun doing the thing that sort of gives me the most joy? And, you know, going independent, working for yourself. And, you know, some of our colleagues who have done that, you know, they're actually making a living doing it these days. So there's some very interesting choices that journalists have now. You know, do you stick with the mainstream publications, or do you accept this idea that you can have influence going off on your own?
Regarding editors and their interest in video games, I know at NPR, at least, when they were starting up their alt podcast, they actually came to us, me and Rob and Ralph, who were the hosts there, and asked us to do a video game show because they are interested in getting younger viewers and or listeners, I guess, and people who are interested in video games. The average listener at NPR is something like in their 50s and 60s, and they realized that that's not sustainable for a long time. So at least in the podcasting efforts, they're trying to branch out kind of tentatively there. It's harder to get on the air for the main shows like Morning Edition and All Things Considered because there's limited space and there's more important things, I guess they think, like politics and other, you know, things that are actually news. It's hard to squeeze it in there. But with the internet, you've got unlimited space. You can fill in these niches. And video gaming is still kind of a niche, you know, despite all, everything that's being said about how big it's getting and how mainstream it is. If you compare it to movies and TV and music for size of the industrial impact, it's still not really even close. It's growing and it's getting there, but not yet. I'd give it like 10 more years or so and see what happens.
Do you think that, like with websites like Destructoid and other websites where they place more opinion on their bloggings and their news work, do you think that those kinds of ones, fandom sites, are going to have some issues with sites? I know like yours, Enge, you have really good research and you do other stuff. And I know some of your stuff, Kyle, it's pretty research. So, I mean, is there going to be some switches between the fandom sites and the more professional sites? Is there kind of a problem behind that?
I don't see a problem. They fulfill very different needs, you know, for people. I mean, you know, again, you know, Dean's point about sort of the advantage that writing for a mainstream outlet brings, both he and I, it were spot on. And I think, you know, because of that, you know, Dean and I have to approach our coverage differently. Now, I don't say have to as in like, oh my goodness, it's a chore. I mean, that's the way that, you know, I was trained and very likely the way Dean was trained as well. And you know, we get access to a lot of information. Before the blog, there was very little of that that could make it into print. Now I have more of an ability to put it into print, but that doesn't mean I just sort of dump out my notebook and put up rumors and, you know, that kind of stuff. It's like, you know, I'm not going to say that I haven't put up stuff on my blog that's speculative, but I try to make it informed speculation that's backed up by a, you know, reasoned argument and other facts and as many sources as possible. And, you know, but that's what sort of serious journalism is about. You know, the further away you move from that, then you have the freedom to do other things. And I think that's what, you know, if, you know, I can't do continuous round-the-clock game coverage. You know, Destructoid, Kotaku, Joystick, other sites can. And, you know, each of them, you know, we're all responsible with the approach that we take to disseminating information. You know, not all writing is exactly journalism, but, you know, I don't worry about too much about, you know, sort of the future of, you know, of and reporting and things like that. I trust that readers are educated enough to figure out which is which, and if they're not, well, they'll learn the hard way.
I think blogging gets a bad rap sometimes because people think you're just, you know, stealing content from other people. You throw it up there and you get paid for it. You know, you're not doing any real work. Well, you know, first of all, the bigger blogs like Game Life and Joystick and Kotaku, they all post a good deal of original stuff that kind of gets lost in the, you know, dozens of posts that go up every day. It's kind of, I think they need to find a way to really highlight the things that they're doing original reporting on. And it might not be the size of original reporting that you get from a place like Newsweek or even GameStop. There are things that we add to the conversation, I feel, through blogs. And secondly, I think there's a difference between what I call responsible blogging and irresponsible blogging, where with irresponsible blogging, you see something and it's just a gut reaction. If it's interesting, you know, post it. You don't look into it. You don't go into the context of anything at all. You just see it and regurgitate it. Whereas responsible blogging, you look into the issue a little bit. You, you know, maybe spend 10 or 15 minutes Googling about it at least to see where the original source is, to get some context about how true or not a rumor might be. These are the kind of things that blogs can do, you know, pretty instantaneously. You can put up anything, but if you just take a few more minutes before you post and really look into the issue, try and get a new angle on it, then I think that's where blogging can really add to the conversation there.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. And, you know, newspapers that wait 24 hours to deliver the news about some event to somebody, you know, they just sort of have another thing coming if all the bloggers can more immediately post and react to news. And I think that the area where the bloggers really just sort of have to use their caution is when they have the attitude of posting first and having their readers correct them. You know, that's just, yeah, it's just not a wise policy for anybody. It gets you in trouble.
Yeah, that immediacy is a blessing and a curse, you know, because if you're too fast, then you're liable to make mistakes. But if you're not fast enough, then someone's liable to beat you to it. So,
mm-hmm. Well, from talking to publicists and game developers and things like that, I think one of the issues that they have with blogs is that, you know, assertability. You know, a lot of blogging, and look, I mean, not to say that this isn't true of print journalism as well, but I think it's even more true of blogs, is like fire and forget. So I'll get a post up, and if I get it wrong, well, I'll just correct it afterwards or whatever, like that kind of thing. And so I think people feel like there's a constant blurring between, you know, what's fact, what's rumor, what's speculation, what's opinion, and all of those things. And then there's the tone of the blogs that, you know, sort of, I know, enrages some people in the community, and I mean the community in developing and publishing, because they sort of feel like, why are these people, you know, for them it's weird. Like, the enthusiast press started out as just that. It was enthusiastic about games. It didn't mean that every game got a good review, but if you look at review scores lean in a positive direction. There are very few reviewers that sort of use the entire range of scores. You know, they tend to be, you know, previews are written very upbeat and very positive and, you know, optimistic about the quality of games. And so to have, you know, bloggers come along who are sort of seem to be operating and are being grouped in the enthusiast mindset, but all of a sudden they're bringing, you know, snark and attitude to the table, there are a lot of people who are sort of like, wait, whoa, what's going on here? And, you know, some of them, I think, don't really understand that a big part of the reason for snark isn't just because bloggers like to write that way. I think a lot of them do. Snark is fun. I engage in it from time to time. But it also has to do with generating the comments. They're going to get people, you know, posting in the comment boards and the message boards, and then checking back in to see what other people say. That drives up the page views. That drives up ad revenue. So there's actually a financial motive to sort of, you know, bring it with attitude. And I'm not saying that I don't think that those are, you know, nefarious motives on the part of bloggers, but I think, you know, publicists and developers and publishers are going to have to come to grips with, you know, what are the real dynamics that underpin what's going on with a number of enthusiast blogs.
I have a question for you guys. Like, what are some of the posts that get you the most traffic? I don't know if you actually look at that or not, but in our case, we had two posts that drew a lot more traffic than anything else we had ever done. And, you know, one of them was posting a few days early about the announcement about the Xbox 360 Elite, that it was coming. And in that post, I described, you know, what I knew for sure and what I didn't know. So there was some informed speculation, as Engai described it, and most of it was, you know, fairly accurate at based on the actual announcement, and that was following reports that had already been out about you know, by Engadget and by Game Informer. And I think the service we were trying to do with that post was to say, you know, those rumors that you've heard about, you know, they're mostly true. They're mostly true on this point. And so you could address a rumor and establish, you know, try to say what was true about it. So that's one thing that that journalists can bring to the table, I think. And another is the post we did on the Xbox 360 owner who had to go through 7 machines. You know, it was just a unique post that people hadn't written about so much anymore. People had kind of forgotten how many forgotten about all the reliability problems there were with the 360 until we wrote about this one guy. And then everybody just started piling in with their own stories about, well, yeah, I went through a bunch of 360s as well. So I'm curious, I'm curious about what you guys post that actually gets the most attention.
I don't pay too much close attention to the traffic numbers, but by and large, I think the largest traffic we get is when we do live blogging stuff. I remember 2 a.m. to cover the Japanese press conference where they revealed the final details about the Wii, and we got a translator on there who was scanning all the Japanese websites, and we were basically just translating and adding context to everything that was coming out and posting it live. And there were people who stayed up with us, these Nintendo fans, who actually wanted it, that very second. And then the next day, when there was the American press conference, we did the same thing. At GDC, when they were doing the keynotes, both for Sony and Nintendo, we did live blogging there. And, people really want the immediacy there. Obviously, you could read about it a few hours later and get all the important stuff. But I think the readers want to feel like they're there. They want to feel like they're at GDC and actually sitting at this keynote, and live blogging, provides a way to do that while you're just sitting at your desk at work trying to procrastinate whatever it is you're supposed to be doing.
For me, my traffic boosts really tend to come from did I get featured on the front page of Newsweek, and more importantly, did I get featured on the front page of MSNBC? Anything else is pretty immaterial to what the traffic does or doesn't do. So regardless of how good my posts are, how bad my posts are, it's all about placement. I will say that the one that has had the longest tail was one that I did that was reporting the anonymous sources. They had to be anonymous. But basically that sort of gave some detail and color as to how Sony lost the exclusivity on both Grand Theft Auto 4 and Assassin's Creed. That one just sort of keeps, it got good pickup, though it wasn't actually featured on the front page, but it also got, it also just keeps coming up. So that was something I was really fortunate that I had some good sources who let me in. And the thing was that I went to Sony and did an interview with Jack Tretton and sort of put it to him. Because at the end of the day, it's like, I trust my sources, but, I want to know, what's he going to say? And what was interesting is that he didn't even use the Washington sort of, way of wiggling out by saying, that's outrageous, or that's crazy. I mean, he just sort of tried to change the subject and say, well, we would never encourage them to go on to other platforms, but they had other reasons, which... And there's some other stuff I didn't put in the story. And it's like, it's not that Jack wasn't telling the truth. He was. He just sort of switched the subject. There were some very real reasons at Sony and with Ken Kutaragi and decisions that they were making that, caused them to lose out on exclusivity. But, it really, traffic just depends on placement for me.
Ngai brings up one of these points about sort of the nature of successful blogging, and that is the subject of linking and, the new influencers. Book goes into this in great detail about how if you link to other people and they reciprocate, then your traffic just grows and grows. And then some of these major portals as well, they will go out and crawl the web, and they will pick up whatever news story is done very fast, and also just captures a subject well. So Google News. If you get picked up by Google News, your traffic just starts soaring. If you're not picked up by Google News, then it just sort of grows one by one. But the more people that link to you in the blogging world, the more traffic you get. And it can be for the dumbest of things as well. Like I did a post on a Halo 2 for the PC coming out on May 8th, just saying in three sentences, here's an observation about this. It's coming out in... May 8th, and then I stuck the press release in the bottom of it. That turned into one of our most trafficked posts. It's kind of ridiculous.
Well, let me go ahead and pull us back to another question I had. A lot of people are being critical about the way that game developers and journalists are kind of getting together. I know with one fighting game, a person, I believe it was Virtua Fighter, they got one of the IGN editors got their person inside of the game. And there's been other things where, with game editors leaving, such as Luke Smith working now for Bungie instead of being in journalist now. Do you think that that's going to become a problem, or is that something that you see as a problem in game journalism?
I don't see it as a problem in that, you know, everyone sort of makes their own decisions as to what they find, where their ethical lines are, and then, you know, the readers are going to judge. I mean, you know, for instance, there are people, there are enthusiast outlets that can accept paid travel from the companies that they cover, because otherwise they wouldn't be able to afford to get to the places and the companies want the coverage. There are other outlets, you know, certainly mainstream press and certain other enthusiast outlets that don't permit that. So, you know, that depends. I mean, I think as far as having someone appear in a game, yeah, that's, you know, dicey. But, you know, this might be unfair, but I think you can't look, just because something has journalism at the beginning or the end of its name doesn't mean that it's all the same. And so for me, you know, working for Newsweek, I have to abide by Newsweek standards, and I can't get too worked up about what someone at IGN is or isn't doing. You know, is that crossing the line? It's crossing some line, but, you know, at the end of the day, I think for the enthusiast audience, at least as traditionally defined, I think the readers would probably get a kick out of knowing that the guy who's you know, previews, reviews, editorials, whatever that they read, is in the game, you know. And you know, you see people from CNN turning up in movies and newscasters and things like that. So I don't think you can just sort of put that on games. And as far as Luke sort of crossing over, you know, again, you know, you had Sidney Blumenthal cross over from The New Yorker into the Clinton administration. You had Tony Snow leave Fox News and go work for the Bush administration. I mean, I think you see this kind of thing. It's not rare. It's not unusual. I think the bigger issue is just sort of, you know, what happens if the best and the brightest minds in game journalism, you know, go into games? What happens if Dean, you know, goes to work for Nintendo or, you know, something like that? I mean, you know, it would be a bit of a loss. And
I don't think they'd take me.
Bungie is a bit of a loss.
Maybe they'd take you at Microsoft.
Scary thought.
Yeah, I'm doing a story on this actually for Game Daily about journalists going into development or you know, in PR for publishers. And I found that a lot of them just really get tired of journalism after a while. A few get into journalism with the explicit intent as a stepping stone to, you know, find out more about the industry, to meet people, and then go on to what they actually want to do development. But more often, I feel, you know, you're working under deadline pressure for X number of years, and, you know, you're writing about game after game, you're getting the real big picture about things, and it's great, but you know, there's a lot of burnout there, and I find a lot of people who I'm talking to say they kind of feel the need to put up or shut up. You know, they've been covering these games, they've played a lot of them, but they've never really created anything, and they want to see from the inside if they can actually, you know, make a difference in the industry. So I don't really see that the phenomenon of people going from journalism to development as a sign that they're too cozy. I feel it's a sign that, you know, they love video games and they just want to do something with video games for their career, but they've kind of had enough of the journalism tech. Now, I don't know if that's going to change.
Mm-hmm. I find it
journalism also doesn't pay very well, I think, mm-hmm. is something that's
true
sort of not as spoken about. But it's, mm-hmm. I mean, you know, I've definitely talked with, you know, some people who've made the transition, and, you know, the money's definitely better on the other side of the fence, depending on which outlet you're working for.
I think the people who are valuable to game companies are people with an encyclopedic knowledge of games. I think in that sense, the employees of game companies can come from anywhere as long as they have that. And so journalists who cover the industry for a long time are some of the people who have that. And I think that would help make them much better or much more useful to game companies. And I don't necessarily have a problem with that. I think it's it's proper for us to keep a light on all of these practices that happen, and that to know that there are game companies that are paying for trips for journalists, and if we shine a light on the fact that some game company created, you know, are paid for an extremely extravagant trip, you know, then you know, it's interesting to write about something like that, to make it public. While I'm, you know, I'm not necessarily, you know, bent out of shape by a lot of these things, and I do suffer from the fact that I can't accept the free trips, and I have a limited travel budget, and so I can't get everywhere. I'm not out really pointing angry fingers at everybody now.
There's kind of a fuzzy line there.
I'm happy that there are journalists out there who say can shine a light on anything that would be really, really unethical.
There's kind of a fuzzy line between, you know, what's really going to influence a journalist and what's not. I think, you know, accepting a trip to Hawaii to cover Dead or Alive beach volleyball too, you know, that might be over the line, but, you know, going to an event and accepting orders from the people is not as much. It's really hard to put a line somewhere and saying, okay, this is okay to accept, this is not okay to accept. So some outlets say, okay, we just can't accept anything, and some outlets say, oh, we'll just accept everything. I don't really think that's the solution either. You know, it's every outlet, I think, has to come to its own terms about how comfortable it is getting close to these companies, and how much it'll affect them.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's. A final question I got for all of you then is, since this is a very early industry that we're in, game journalism, what are some things, especially with you and Dean and Ngai, since you guys have a lot of experience outside in the mainstream media, what are some things that you see people who are in game journalism need to improve?
I tend to... Well, first of all, I actually look first more to sort of like what I can learn from, you know, video game journalists. So I think one of the things that I've done that's been, you know, sort of good, I deliberately don't post in message boards or sort of court the community in that way, you know, just because if you look at what sort of happens to, you know, David Jaffe or Dennis Dyack when they go into the message boards, I mean, they're fans, but they're also guys that are just out to tear them down, and I understand that impulse. You know, it's like when I was in college and I wrote for the student paper, you know, I would tear down idols. That's what, you know, testosterone-laced people do. But I do find message boards useful, particularly the ones that have, like, a better-than-average signal-to-noise ratio, because of the hive mind effect. So on any given topic, you know, I may know more than one person, two person, 10 people. I may have better thoughts, faster thoughts than 10 people. I may have played more games than 10 people. You go up to 100 people, that's almost certainly not true. You go to 1,000 people, it's definitely not true. So you can leverage the power of the hive mind to help clarify your own thinking, and I find I do that a lot for, you know, whether it's thinking about the 360 Elite or thinking about the, you know, PS3 or other things. I find that, you know, reading a good message board exchange between people is clarifying, because you kind of get a variety of sides of the topic, and then I can be like, yeah, that makes sense, no, discard that. So I still filter it, but I find that useful. As far as what game journalists, you know, or enthusiast journalists, bloggers, so people outside of mainstream can do to improve, I would say the most important thing is to raise the standards, you know, in terms of, you know, maybe it's worth it to slow down a bit to make the extra call to, you know, abide by agreements with publishers where they're not being abided by, like embargoes and those kinds of things, or to reject embargoes entirely, like a CNET does, and say, hey, we're just going to dig this stuff up on our own.
but I think it's to sort of keep raising the bar for what it is they're doing. There are things where it makes sense to do things just like the mainstream does and things that they where they don't, but I think in terms of standards, I think the higher the standards are for the quality of the copy, for, you know, the ethical interactions and things like that, I think it'll own coverage better and to keep being transparent. So I think what Kyle said about, you know, maybe sort of putting in there about, you know, hey, here's what was paid for and what wasn't and those kinds of things, I think the readers probably would like to know, and those who don't care can skip it.
But you know, one thing I find very useful about the blogs are that you can ask questions, and my colleague Mike Antonucci does this a lot, where, you know, he asks a question out there, and about a, you know, a few dozen folks chime in, and you can then just see a lot of material that you just didn't know. It's sort of like that Wikipedia effect. Or the hive mind effect, and we take some of those and we actually publish them in the paper, and so readers in that sense can sort of feel a more personal connection into the main product, you know, the newspaper, and that's one of those, you know, great things of this whole new world of blogging, and I think I'd agree with Engai that posting a lot of rumors. It not only creates this sort of you know, swarm effect of everybody, you know, you basically just create a lot of work for the rest of us as well to who are trying to verify which rumors are correct or not, thinking about a post before you pull the trigger on it, and verifying as much as you can before you pull a trigger on it is in my mind where everybody can improve.
Personally, I'd like to see more game journalists who are journalists first and gamers second, kind of. I feel like for a long time, especially in the 90s, most of the people in video game magazines were, you know, gamers who stumbled onto a job and could string together a few sentences and therefore got their position. And now I think you really need people who are trained somehow in journalism. If you know how to be a journalist, if you've taken the courses or if you've been a journalist about something else, then, you know, you can write about anything. You know the principles of sourcing, of style, of what to put up top of the article, but leave out of the article entirely. You know, these are important things that work in any writing, and game writing is kind of lacking in those things right now. I think a lot of game journalists or people who really love games have a lot of that game knowledge, but don't necessarily have as much writing skill in there. So I'd like to see that kind of come about more in journalism. And it's starting to happen as the space is getting bigger. But I would like to see that continue. And as for features, the one specific feature I would like to see in more websites and magazines is kind of a focus on older games. You know, everyone seems to be focused on what's new, what's just come out, or what's coming out next. And we're really starting to get a 30, 40-year history of games that, you know, you can look at these older games as cultural artifacts and really get into what made them important. Edge has a great feature where they, Edge magazine out of the UK, where they look at old games and kind of give it a scholarly critique of what it meant to its time, what it's meant to games that come after. You know, it goes a lot deeper than just the retro sections in some magazines where they do, you know, a half-page review. I'd really like to see more of that kind of video game scholarship come out in the press.
You know, for the mainstream media, what I'd like to see are deeper reviews, you know, where it's clear that the player played a lot of a game or maybe even finished a game, you know. You just... very often in their rush to publish something very fast or just at the same day that it comes out, they don't really do a real review. And, you know, I'm not sure how to fix that problem because you do want to be timely, but you want to add some value with your review as well.
I would suggest that I think it would be, so I agree with Dean, I think it's hard to do a real review of a game in the same amount of space that you would give to a movie review.
a movie review is a narrative experience that lasts for, you know, 90 minutes to 3 hours. A game is an interactive experience that, you know, generally is like 8 hours and can be as many as 40. And, you know, I think more mainstream outlets need to do that, or that kind of review. I'm going to be hopefully launching some reviews on my site soon, and it won't be that. I have another approach that I think might be interesting, which I can't really talk about right now. But I will say that I think online is the place where you can do reviews that are more in-depth. I think you can do something where you where maybe it's something like where, you know, you're sort of filing dispatches as you play the game and sort of communicate, like, what it's like to go through that experience. I think sort of summing things up like you do in a book review or a movie review or a concert review, I think works, but I don't think that that really captures what the experience of playing a game is like. And so I think while game reviews have sort of modeled themselves on a hybrid of movie reviews and car reviews, I think that needs to change, whether it's in the enthusiast press or in the mainstream. And that's like why, you know, what Steven and I did with Versus Mode, and, you know, maybe we didn't talk about the gameplay as much as we could have, sort of criticism than reviews, but I think giving it that space allowed to get to certain aspects of it that you wouldn't get in almost anyone's game review. And I just think that, you know, reviewing games needs to be completely rethought if we're going to get to part of what Dean's talking about.
Well, okay. Well, thank you guys so much. We've had a lot of time here. Wish we had more. We have so much more we could talk about. But let me go ahead and just review for everybody our guests. We had Engai Kroll, who is the general editor of Newsweek. We had Dean Takahashi. He is a columnist for the San Jose Mercury News. And we have Kyle Orland, who is a freelance writer who contributes a lot to Joystick and other blogs, and also has a podcast called Press Start. And Dean Takahashi has a podcast called Dean and Nooch on Gaming. I would definitely recommend listening. I listen to both of them. They're actually really great stuff to listen to. So I want to thank you so much, Engai, for coming on.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you so much, Dean, for coming on.
Thank you.
And Kyle, thank you for coming on.
No problem.
Well, thank you so much for listening to the show. I want to go ahead and thank not only you for listening, but also to our guests for coming on the show. If you have any questions or comments that you'd like to go ahead and email me, you can do that through our website at www.gameacthotline.com or through our email at gameacthotline@gmail.com. We'd also like to thank Noel Sleep for letting us use his music for the show. So that's going to be it for this episode. We'll go ahead and we'll let you get back to your day. So you guys, have a great day. Remember, the opinions expressed on cross-platform are the opinions of the sole person and not of their companies or subsidiaries. Copyright 2007, Luke Stapley.